Okay. Good. Very nice to be here with you. I first came to this temple in 1989. I was in the process of doing a teaching tour around the U.S. and wound up in Seattle, and one woman said, I want to take you to this Chinese temple to meet some really cool nuns. She didn't say that. So she brought me here in 1989. I met Venerable Jendi then and Venerable Ningjia. And this friendship has, you know, blossomed since then. Actually, one of my books, Working with Anger, it started out here at this temple. I gave a talk, Working with Anger, and it was made into this small booklet and then later expanded, but the talk, the original talk, was given here. And then Venerable Jendi has been an incredible aid to the Abbey. I don't know what would have happened without her. When we began ordaining people, we needed a certain number of senior nuns to come and help give the ordination. And so she was always there, coming and helping us translate things and learn how to, you know, because we fought in our monastery, we follow the Dharmaguptaka Vinaya, the same one followed in Taiwan and China. And so she was busy teaching us, you know, walk here, bow there. Did you notice I can do Chinese bowing now? Yeah, so all this took a while. And then she also began to come to teachings with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So we've had a very nice interchange that way, you know, as friends and as practitioners. So it's really nice to be back here again. Before we start, you have a prayer sheet, I think. So I was going to ask Venerable Senpei, we'll do the recitations. And then we'll have a few minutes of silence just to calm our mind and center ourselves. Okay. When we do the recitations, we imagine that we're in the presence of all of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all of the holy beings, and that we're surrounded by all the sentient beings. And we take refuge, we generate love and compassion, joy and equanimity, we make offerings and so on. And for those of you who are, you know, struggling with what's happening in the country and in the world these days, it's very helpful when we do these kinds of recitations, because the recitations are directing our minds and helping us to develop very positive qualities. When I do them, I usually imagine the entire U.S. Congress around me, you know, and it's very effective, you know. You have Ted Cruz on one side and Donald Trump on the other side, and, you know, and you imagine them generating love and compassion together with you, okay? So it's a way to kind of transform what's happening. Sometimes I put the young ISIS soldiers, you know, the boys who were, you know, propagandized to think that they were doing something noble. I put them around me and imagine them generating love and compassion and paying homage to the Buddha too. And I find this very helpful for my mind and hopefully a way to, you know, bring these people in on some level to something that will bring peace and harmony instead of war and friction. Okay, so you can think like that when we're reciting this too.
Namah. To the entire line of spiritual mentors, I make a request.
Dayaka
one other person I wanted to acknowledge. I know there's many old friends here, and I'm quite happy to see all of you. But I have to pay a special thanks to Steve Wilhelm, because he was my writing teacher when I wrote the first book, Open Heart, Clear Mind. And Steve's a journalist, and I gave him the manuscript, and I said, could you look at this? And he gave it back to me completely marked up with red ink, just like all my college professors did. Yeah, but I learned how to write through Steve's kindness, and he looked at some of my other manuscripts as well, so thank you very much. Okay, so tonight we're going to be talking about the three higher trainings. So I want to put this in the context of where it fits in the whole Buddhist path. So you may know that the Buddha's first teaching was it's usually translated the Four Noble Truths, but that's not a very good translation. It's much better to say the four truths known by noble beings or known by Arya beings. Aryas being people who see reality directly as it is. Otherwise, if you say the four noble truths and the first truth is suffering, well, there's nothing very noble about suffering. Yeah, so it's not such a good translation. And actually, suffering isn't very good translation either for the first truth, because we can't say everything is suffering, can we? We can say things are unsatisfactory. Now, when we look around in our world, yeah, things are unsatisfactory. We don't manage to find any total satisfaction. It's just like Mick Jagger told us. Yeah, can't get no satisfaction in samsara, that's it. Okay. But it's not all suffering. We're not in pain all the time. Okay? But we have this, you know, we live in this unsatisfactory state. And so that's the first thing the Buddha taught. And the second thing was that this unsatisfactory state has causes. And its causes are not, you know, some creator being or some extraterrestrial something. You know, the causes of our misery actually lie inside ourselves, especially our own ignorance. We don't know the way things exist. And in fact, we actively misapprehend how things exist. And this gives rise to greed, to anger, to jealousy, to pride. I think you know all of those things. Yeah. So, you know, these were the first two things that the Buddha taught. Of course, most of us, when we come to spiritual practice, we don't want to hear about dissatisfaction and its causes. We want to hear about light and love and bliss. Okay. But the Buddha had to, you know, teach us how to look at our own situation clearly, because until we were able to see our own situation and understand what caused it, we won't have any wish or inspiration to free ourselves from it. So those first two of the truths of dissatisfaction and its causes being ignorance, anger, and attachment are very necessary. But he didn't stop with just those two. He also taught the last two of the four truths. So true cessation, so the stopping or cessation of the states, the unsatisfactory states, and of ignorance, anger, and attachment. And then the path to follow, the path to train our mind in to attain that state of nirvana or actual freedom. Okay? So when we talk about the last two truths, we're talking about how to overcome our situation and really use our potential to its utmost. Because Buddhism has a quite expansive view of human potential. You know, we usually think of ourselves as like, I'm just little old me, and I can't do anything right, and you know, I'm depressed all the time, and I have a bad temper. My life is like, bleh. You know, that's how we see ourselves, but that's not how the Buddha saw us. The Buddha looked at us and saw, you know, wow, here's somebody who has the potential to become fully awakened. Here's somebody whose the fundamental nature of their mind is something pure, untainted. They have the potential to generate impartial love and compassion for all beings. They have the potential to realize the nature of reality. I mean, the Buddha saw us as beings with like just overflowing with potential that was untapped and unused. And so, you know, he taught us the path of how to use that potential. So one way to describe the path is in terms of the three higher trainings, which is the topic of our talk tonight. Higher training in ethics, in concentration, and in wisdom. Another way of describing the true path is in terms of the Eightfold Noble Path. Okay, starting out with correct view, correct intention, going on to correct speech, correct action, right livelihood, and then continuing on to right joyous effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Very conveniently, the Eightfold Noble Path, you can subsume the eight into the three higher trainings. So they aren't contradictory. You just categorize them in that way. If you like lists and numbers, Buddhism is a really good religion for you. Because there's the Four Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path and the Three Higher Trainings. And then you have the Two Truths, you have the Three Jewels. You know, we have lists galore. But it's actually very helpful to remember, you know, in training our mind and remembering the teachings. So when we start on the path, okay, if we use the model of the three higher trainings, and by the way, they're called higher trainings because they are done with refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, so they're higher for that reason. But the whole thing starts out with ethical conduct. Yeah. Now, in America, do people like to hear about ethical conduct? No. Okay. We excel in unethical conduct. Yeah. Just ask any CEO, ask any politician. You know, the society is filled with the opposite of ethical conduct. And this is precisely why we have so many societal problems. You know? And also why we have so many personal problems, too. Do you remember going to Sunday school and they taught morality? You don't remember that. Oh, I remember teaching morality. Morality, ugh. It was like, you know, you can't do this, and you can't do that, and you can't do the other thing. You know, it was always kind of a lesson on no. Yeah. Don't do this, don't do that, don't. And nobody ever told you why don't do all those things. So, of course, you know, once you could get out from under your parents' gauge, you went to do them and see. See, because they must be pretty exciting if you weren't supposed to do them. So we went out and did them. But what I learned from that whole experience is that when I don't monitor what's going on in my mind and I don't monitor what I say and what I do, I wind up creating a lot of messes in my life. Okay, do any of you have that problem? Yeah? Of creating messes in your life? And, you know, you get in a situation and you go, how in the world did I get here? You know, what is happening? This is craziness. And then if you really look back, you know, we can trace it through some choices that we made, some decisions that we made along the way. Yeah. And we thought those decisions were going to bring us happiness, but instead they created big messes. Yeah. And then of course we have to clean up the mess. And you know, it's like creating a mess, it's like breaking your leg. You can get, you know, you can repair your leg, but it's better not to break it. So it's same with our messes, you know, we can clean them up kind of, but it's better, would have been better not to make them to start with. Okay. So this is, I think, where ethical conduct comes in. Yeah, because ethical conduct is teaching us how to create the causes for happiness and how to avoid the causes of messes. Okay? I you know, for people who don't like hearing the word morality or ethical conduct, it sounds too heavy. I've renamed ethical conduct. Okay? I call it stop being a jerk. Okay? Because, you know, when I create a mess, I'm being a jerk. And how do I create messes? Yeah. Well, it's so remarkable that the way in which I create messes in my own and other people's lives happened to be the Buddha's list of the 10 pathways of destructive action. Very coincidental, isn't it? So, okay, so how am I a jerk? How do I create a mess? Well, first of all, I harm living beings physically. Yeah? So, killing them. So, I don't think any of us are going to go out and kill a human being, but you know what I did for my 21st birthday? My friends took me out. We were going to have a good time, you know? My 21st birthday. So, we went to one place where you pick out the live lobsters and they throw them in the boiling water just for you. And this was something exciting and wonderful to do. Yeah. And I didn't realize until years later that, oh my goodness, you know, that was some living being who just wanted to stay alive. And, you know, and I had him thrown in boiling water and then ate it. And I wouldn't particularly enjoy somebody throwing me in boiling water and then eating me. So it really made me think about, you know, different ways in which we harm others physically. Then stealing, taking, you know, miss stealing, everybody goes, stealing, stealing. Yeah, that's what the other people do. You know, the people who break into houses at night. It's not just people break into houses and nice. In fact, I don't know how many of those there are. But what about white collar crime? You know, in New York, they just sent one of their, he's been an assemblyman for like 40 years, and he's going to prison for stealing. Except they have a fancy term for stealing when you're white collar. But, you know, people, look what happened on Wall Street, you know, our recession in 08, you know, people misusing other people's money, it's a form of stealing, yeah, creates a lot of problems. Then unwise and unkind sexual behavior, yeah, so let's skip that one, no one wants to hear about that one. Yeah. So the primary one about that is if you're in a relationship going with somebody who's somebody else, or if you're not in a relationship going with somebody who is, and it creates a whole lot of problems for a little bit of pleasure. Yeah, and I can't tell you the number of places I go, you know, people come and talk to me. I hear all sorts of stories from people. And they say, you know, I was a little kid and, you know, mom or dad was out having an affair. And, you know, it influenced me when I was growing up. And of course, mom and dad think, oh no, the kids don't know what's going on. Kids are smart. They know what's going on. Yeah. And so it causes a lot of problems in families. And then lying. Okay, so none of us like to say we lie. We just say something in a skillful way so that it won't hurt somebody else's feelings. Right? Does that sound polite enough? Yeah, I don't lie. I just, for the benefit of the other person, lie. You know how we justify our own lying? Yeah. Somehow it's out of compassion. But usually, in our mind, we're saying it's out of compassion, so we don't hurt somebody. But usually it's to cover up something we did that we don't want other people to know about. Yeah? If you have a hard time understanding that, ask Bill Clinton. He has had some experience. Yeah, he'll help you understand that one. Yeah? So, you know, we can see. Actually, lying is one of the things that I find very disturbing, because if somebody lies to me, you know, because usually if somebody lies, we find out about it. I feel very offended when I find out that somebody lied to me, because to me, if somebody lies to me, it's like they're saying, "I don't trust you to keep your cool when you know the truth." Yeah, to me, lying shows a lack of trust in me as the listener. And, you know, I can bear the truth. In fact, I can bear the truth much better than I can bear somebody lying to me. So if somebody lies, I immediately, you know, the red flag goes up, like, you know, because if this person isn't going to tell me the truth, then I really can't trust very much of what they do. Okay, so lying, creating disharmony is another one we do when we're in our jerk mode. Yeah, you know how we create disharmony. I'm jealous of somebody in the workplace, so I go around and talk to everybody else in the office and turn them all against this person. Yeah. Any of you ever done that? Who, me? Yeah. Well, yeah, we have, haven't we? You know, created a lot of disharmony. In our families, boy, we do this in our families too. Yeah, we try and turn one relative against the other relative, often out of jealousy, out of anger, out of a clinging attachment. Yeah. And then we wind up with these lovely family dinners like we just had last week. Yeah. And then there's harsh words. It's another way of being a jerk. But of course, when we're in the middle of saying harsh words, which again, we do out of compassion, right? Right? When you tell somebody off, and when you point out their faults to him, and when you tell them how much they hurt your feelings and how all your problems are their fault, aren't you doing it out of total compassion for them so that they'll learn a lesson and don't treat other people that way? Right? Isn't that how we explain it to ourselves? Yeah. And then we, you know, begin to tell them everything that they've done wrong because we've kept a very nice list of it in our minds. Do you do that sometimes? You know, especially with the people you know very well. Yeah. And you know sometime, you know, you're close to people, so sometime or another you're probably going to have a fight. But in the meantime, there's all these little things they do that just bug you to death. But you can't have a fight over every little thing. So you kind of have a checklist in your mind, you know? Okay, Saturday my husband did this, and Sunday he did that, and Monday he did this. And then, when you finally have a fight, then you have all your ammunition. So it's not only the thing that set off the fight, but it's everything you've been storing up. And we yell and scream, or we get so angry that we don't talk. Yeah, we just go in our room, slam the door, and don't talk to anybody. And then we think that when we act like that, yeah, we yell and scream, or we don't talk, we think that by acting like that, that's going to make the other person feel so sorry for what they did that they're going to apologize. How often has that happened? Yeah. Does that happen? They actually come and apologize? No. They don't come and apologize. We keep waiting for them to come and apologize. Okay. Yeah, it's so interesting how, especially with the people we're close to, when we get upset with them, yeah, we say the most abominable things that we would never say to a stranger. Yeah, think about it. Would you ever say to a stranger what you say to a family member? Think about it. Yeah, would you? I mean, most people not. We're much politer to strangers, even if they cut us off on the highway. But family members, boy, we will take everything out on them. Yeah. And then they're supposed to apologize after we treat them like that. Usually doesn't work. Not a good strategy. But we keep doing it. Don't we? And then idle talk. Another one that falls into ethical conduct. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Then three mental ones, coveting other people's stuff. Yeah, you know, going into people's home. Oh, Venerable Jinti, what a beautiful small gong you have. This is lovely. Where did you get this? Hint, 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 hint. Yeah? Look at this doily. You must have some very devoted disciples. Yeah, this is home crochet. Look at this. This is gorgeous. Wow. I don't have one of these. Okay. So, coveting. Yeah. Then malice. You know, thinking how we're going to get even with somebody. We do that one in perfect meditation posture. Have you ever done that? A whole meditation session. Sitting there. Oh, money, pay me, oh, money, pay me. My brother, 15 years ago, said something to me. Oh, money, pay me, oh, money, pay me. And he keeps exploiting me like that. Oh, money, pay me, oh, money. And I can't stand this anymore. This has got to stop. I've got to put him in his place. What can I do to hurt his feelings? I'm not even here. And it just goes on for, an hour. No distraction. No distraction. Very single-pointed. And then you hear, oh, my brother's not here. But I just spent a whole hour planning my revenge for something he did 15 years ago. Do you know that one? Anybody here ever done that? Whole meditation session, no distraction. And then, of course, wrong views. So these are just 10 ways, that in which we act unethically and create messes in our own lives and messes in our relationships with other people. And it's so strange because we all want to be happy, don't we? All of us want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. But so many of our actions are involved with these 10. And we think when we're doing them that they're going to bring us happiness. And they consistently bring us problems. But we keep on doing them anyway. Yeah. So that's why I call ethical discipline stop being a jerk. Yeah, because we keep shooting ourselves in the foot. I've also come to the conclusion that a number of our psychological problems, I think, also come from not keeping good ethical conduct. Yeah? Because when we don't act properly towards other living beings, then in our own mind, we have a conscience. Somewhere buried in there, there's a conscience. And we say, what I said to that person was not very good. What I did was not very good. And then we have a lot of, guilt, remorse, different psychological problems. And so I think actually that keeping good ethical conduct is a way to have fewer psychological problems. Now we have way less guilt and remorse when we have good ethical conduct. What do you think? Half of you are sleeping. See, I told you, morality. Okay, but that's the foundation of everything. And whatever type of spiritual path you practice, it all starts with morality, with ethical conduct. And in Buddhism, we talk about the hearer's path, the solitary realizer path, the bodhisattva path. We talk about sutrayana, we talk about vajrayana. All of it starts with ethical conduct. Yeah, with restraining our body and speech, body, speech, and mind from destructive actions. Yeah, and when we do, we're much happier and we have much better relationships with other people. Ethical conduct, like I just said, it's the foundation. And from there, we go on to meditation. We go on to concentration. Now maybe people will wake up. Oh, I want to learn concentration. I want to learn meditation. Yeah. Ethical conduct, I learned that in Sunday school. Meditation, concentration. Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. I want to be enlightened. Yeah. But when we sit down to concentrate, when we have those few minutes at the beginning to watch our breath, is there anybody here who didn't get distracted for those few minutes when we were watching our breath? Yeah, I think most of us, myself included, got distracted at one point or another. Okay? So, there's two mental factors that are very important in developing concentration. One is called mindfulness. The other is called introspective awareness. Now, I know mindfulness is the latest craze, and what was it, Time or Newsweek had a cover on mindfulness. However, okay, now maybe I have to control myself. I'm going to get on a soapbox. Yeah, because this mindfulness craze, you know, it's the way, it's very good, and people are benefiting from it tremendously. But don't confuse the mindfulness craze that you're learning from from therapists or doctors or whatever. Don't confuse that with Buddhist mindfulness. They're different. Okay? So what, you know, is being taught secularly as mindfulness has a Buddhist origin, but it certainly isn't Buddhist mindfulness. Mindfulness in Buddhism has an element of wisdom. It's an ability to place our mind on a virtuous object and keep it there and begin to understand what that object is about. Okay? So traditionally, we have four mindfulness practices: being mindful of our body, of our feelings, happy, unhappy, neutral feelings, and mindfulness of our mind, and then mindfulness of phenomena. And these are very wonderful practices that you do that help develop not only concentration but also wisdom, because we really have a very sharp mind. That's like, if we're doing mindfulness on our body, that it's a sharp mind that can hold the body, you know, as our object of meditation. But then also investigate it at the same time. You know, what is this body? Is this body something clean or is it something foul? Is this body who I am? Is it my identity? Does this body bring pleasure? Does it bring pain? What's the cause of this body? What's the result of this body? Okay? So mindfulness of the body has all those kind of questions and examinations in it, and it helps us develop wisdom. It's not simply the mindfulness that is in the mindfulness craze, where you're just watching whatever comes in your mind. Okay? But my point is here, especially when you're developing concentration, mindfulness is very important because it's what you call up at the beginning of your meditation session to put your mind on the object that you're meditating on. And then introspective awareness is another mental factor that is like a little spy, and it looks and it checks, am I still concentrating on the object that I chose? Or am I falling asleep? Am I distracted? Am I daydreaming? Am I, you know, doing something else? So these two mental factors, mindfulness and introspective awareness, very important to put the mind on the object and then to check and see if we're keeping it on the object. The way to start developing mindfulness and introspective awareness in meditation is to practice it in our daily lives in terms of ethical conduct. Because it's much easier, the initial development of mindfulness and introspective awareness happens when we're practicing ethical conduct. And on that basis, then we're able to bump it up, the level of mindfulness and introspective awareness, when we start doing meditation. Okay. In ethical conduct, mindfulness remembers our precepts. It remembers these 10 non-virtues that I just talked about. You know, because if we don't remember them, we're not going to notice when we do them. Okay? Mindfulness and ethical conduct remembers our values. It remembers our principles. It helps us to remember what kind of person we want to be so that we can go about being that kind of person. And then introspective awareness checks and sees, am I living according to my own values? Or am I being a people pleaser and contradicting my own values because I'm afraid of somebody else not liking me? Or am I giving in, you know, somebody else wants me to go in on kind of a bad business deal and I'm afraid of them and I can't say no. So peer pressure, I'm giving in to peer pressure. Yeah? So this kind of development of mindfulness and introspective awareness when we're practicing ethical conduct helps us really keep our life in order. And it develops those two mental factors, so then when we sit down to meditate, we already have some mindfulness and introspective awareness. Okay? And that's important for developing concentration. Otherwise, we know how it is. You sit down, yeah, one breath, then what am I going to daydream about this session? Or... So there's actually a lot to say about concentration. It deserves a few days to talk about it, actually. But it's a very important quality to generate. So in the three higher trainings, we start with ethical conduct, because that's easier. That's the easiest thing to practice. Then on that basis, we can develop some concentration. And when we have some concentration, that really facilitates us developing wisdom. So there's different kinds of wisdom. All of them are important. And one of the kinds of wisdom is understanding how things exist. Another kind of wisdom understands conventional phenomena, the cause and effect, karma and its effect, how things operate on the conventional level. Okay. Both these kinds of wisdom are important because we have ignorance, which is the opposite of this wisdom, and there's two principal kinds of ignorance, one which misunderstands the nature of reality, and the other one that misunderstands cause and effect in conventional functioning. Okay, so the wisdom has to directly oppose what the ignorance is. Okay, so that's a little bit about the three higher trainings. I outlined them and sketched them out. What I'd like to do now is open it up and for some questions and answers or, you know, some discussion so that you can let me know more what you want to know about these topics. Yeah?
I've worked for some years as a music teacher, so I find that metaphors are helpful in conveying...
Metaphors?
Metaphors. So I'm wondering if you can offer any useful metaphors for doing this inner work of improving our concentration. Mm. Who we are or of our funny situation here.
Okay. Well, the first metaphor just that comes to my mind, about the three higher trainings, the metaphor that's commonly used is if you're going to cut down a tree, okay, you need to... if you ever come to the Abbey, we'll teach you about forestry and cutting down trees. But you need to be able to stand firmly and have your body in a firm position that doesn't wobble. Yeah. You need to know exactly where in the tree to hit. Like if you're using an axe, we don't use axes at the Abbey usually, but this is the metaphor. You need to know where to hit, and you need power in your arms. So ethical conduct is like being able to stand firmly, yeah? Because you need that solid base. You can't cut a tree. You can't develop your mind unless you have some stability. Yeah? So ethical conduct brings that stability. Then, if you're going to cut down the tree, okay, you need to know where on the tree you're going to hit. So that is like wisdom. What is the point that you need to understand? Yeah. How is it that things really exist? How is it that they function? You know, and you need to be able to focus on that point and really go into it. And then, if you're really going to cut down the tree, you know, you need some strength in your arms. If you don't have any strength, you know, you're not going to make a dent. So the strength is like concentration. You can put your mind on the topic of that you're investigating with wisdom and keep it there. Okay? So that's a metaphor that is often used for the three higher trainings and why you need all three. Yeah. And I say this because some people come into Buddhism and it's like, oh, well, I'm going to realize the nature of reality and become Buddha by, you know, next Tuesday. And, you know, they're all full of energy and, you know, this is easy and I'm just going to sit down and realize the nature of reality and get it all together. Then I'm a Buddha, cross that off my list, I can go on and do the next thing. Yeah? And, you know, we come into this with all our naivety, come arrogance, and then we fall flat on our face. So, you know, you really need the three together to get somewhere spiritually.
Mm-hmm. This is useful, thank you. And I'm feeling some hunger or need for this power. Mm-hmm. And intuitively I'm thinking it's about confidence and belief and faith that we can do what needs to be done. And I do see myself not having when I was younger and going for it, I was filled with confidence. Yeah! And now I have lots of doubt. I know Buddhism talks about doubt. So isn't that a way to clean up our doubt, to get our power back?
Okay, so you're saying when we're young, we have lots of confidence. Is it confidence or is it arrogance and stupidity? Yeah? I don't know about you. I mean, I had that too. But when I look back on it now, some of the things I did were like, oh my goodness. Yeah? Stupid. Yeah. So I think, you know, when you get older, you begin to see that, you know, actually we're mortal and we're, you know, when you're young, you're invincible. Other people die, we don't. When you're older, you know, you've watched people die and you begin to realize, you know, this pertains to me too. We become more cautious, okay? The thing is to not go to the other extreme and be overly cautious, yeah? So not to go from overinflation of confidence so that it's arrogance and stupidity and then go to the other extreme of, you know, being super cautious and unwilling to try anything new or unwilling to take a risk. Okay. But confidence is very important on the spiritual path, and confidence is different than arrogance. Arrogance is an inflated view of ourselves. Confidence is an accurate view based on, you know, knowledge that we have the potential to do these things. The potential to do these things doesn't mean that we're going to be able to do them by next Tuesday. Okay? It takes a while to develop our potential. You know, things, when you plant, you have to plant the seed in the ground, and then you have to water it, you have to wait for the temperature, for the weather to change and it to get warmer. You know, you need to get all the causes and conditions together for the seed to grow. So I look at spiritual development and development as a human being in general as a thing of creating the causes. How can I create the causes for the kind of human being I want to be? Instead of, there's the result, how can I grab it? And we tend, you know, in this culture to be very result-oriented, and we want to skip over the process. But the process is the education that allows us to get to the result. Yeah? So I think it's really a thing of, I have a little slogan, be content to create the causes. And if we just keep creating causes, the results are going to come. But if we're always looking for the results, it's like, you know, you planted the seed in February, it's still cold, yeah? And you go out in the garden and dig up the seed the next day to see if it's sprouted. And it hasn't, so you cover it up. Then you dig it up the day after that and it still hasn't sprouted, you know?
It maybe doesn't fit in with the topic, but it's been on my mind. If you would talk a little bit about in the final days, in one's final days, free of pain or not with pain relievers.
Oh, so you're talking about when somebody's terminally ill, is it good to use pain medication or not?
Well, and maybe you're not ill, maybe it's just that time.
But you're terminal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I think it depends very much on the individual. Spiritual practitioners, by and large, will want to avoid pain medication when they can. However, when the pain is so great that you can't concentrate on your spiritual practice, then it's good to have some pain relief, because then that enables you to focus on your spiritual practice. Okay? For people who don't have much of a spiritual practice, I don't know how much it matters one way or the other. Okay.
So the stereotype of Buddhism that many people may have is, you know, people living in remote places and you know, meditating on the mountain, and you know, of course this has changed, and now we live in this modern world where there's so much happening. And you know, I think even His Holiness the Dalai Lama said earlier this year that it's time for people to get more involved in what's happening in the world and try to influence things in a positive way. I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit about something of how you see how can we benefit the world and still focus internally on developing ourselves.
Okay, so how can we benefit the world and still keep up our spiritual practice and grow internally ourselves? Because actually those two things are both needed. Yeah, it's not a question of either or. It's a question of how to balance those two, plus everything else that's going on in our life, in a reasonable way. And so that balance is going to be up to each individual, because everybody is in a different situation. But, you know, we definitely need the inner work, because if we don't do the inner work, how are we going to benefit anybody else? Yeah? If we can't control our own anger, how are we going to help reduce the anger of the world? If we can't control our own greed, how are we going to help reduce the greed in the world? Yeah? If we can't sacrifice, you know, driving somewhere just because we feel like it, then how are we, you know, can we, yeah, because we want to be able to get in our car and go here and go there and do whatever we want. And recycling really is a pain in the neck, and I don't want to do that. But all these other political leaders in Paris are supposed to do something for the environment. Yeah, but don't ask me to sacrifice anything that's going to inconvenience me. Yeah, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, so we have to do our own internal work to be able to control our own greed, our own anger, our own ignorance, in some, you know, to some extent. And then, based on that, you know, to find, and we're all going to have our own different areas where we have interest, where we feel according to our own interests, our own talents and abilities, where we want to make a contribution. And so some people's contribution may be, you know, taking care of Uncle Joe and Aunt Ethel, you know, and other people's contribution is going to be doing something about climate change, and somebody else is going to work in a homeless shelter, and somebody else is going to teach elementary school. And everybody's going to have a different way to contribute. But the thing is that we need to create a good motivation for what we're doing, and that's done through our spiritual practice. And we also need to develop the ability to keep working in a steady way, even though things don't go as quickly as we want them to, and they don't turn out exactly the way we want them to. No? Because if we have a lot of expectation, and then people don't act the way we want them to act, then we usually throw up our hands and get frustrated and say, well, forget it. And if we have that kind of thought, which comes from a lack of fortitude in our spiritual practice, then we're not going to be able to help anybody else. Yeah, because contributing to society is going to take a whole lot of effort. Yeah. I mean, do you think that Ted Cruz and Donald Trump are going to change overnight? Yeah. So, as well as all the other people? Yeah. I mean, it's going to take time, and we need to have a very strong mind that can continue to work for the betterment of the world without getting discouraged. Yeah.
Hi, thank you so much. It's so nice to meet you. You've mentioned children a couple of times.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty new to the path, like as far as trying to commit to the practice. But I'm interested in, and maybe others know this as well, what are simple ways to introduce some of these principles? I mean, we've talked about things that adults struggle probably their whole life with, but how do I plant the seeds of some of these teachings with very small children, and do you have resources that you might recommend?
Okay, so how do you introduce some of these teachings to small children? I think the best way is through living them yourself. That's the hard way, but it's the best way. I get asked this question a lot. Where can I take my kids where they can learn about Buddhism? Yeah. I said, you have to model the good behavior you want your kids to have. Kids are smart. They watch how mom and dad act, and they copy them. Yeah. My mother used to say, do as I say, not as I do. But that doesn't work for kids, yeah? So the hard thing is really to model it. On another level, I mean, I think just even when you're frustrated, to be able to say, I'm frustrated, to teach your kids how to label their feelings, yeah? And like, okay, I'm angry, I accept that. But that doesn't give me a right to disturb somebody else's peace. Yeah. And so I think sometimes sharing your own process with your kids can be very, very helpful. Yeah. You're mommy and you say, I need a time out. Because sometimes when you're mommy and daddy, you need a time out, don't you? Yeah. And I always marvel, you know, because I always see parents screaming at their kids, sit down and shut up, you know? But how much do kids ever see their parents sitting quietly and peacefully? Do parents model that for their kids? Yeah. If you do a morning meditation practice, even for a short while, kids are going, wow, Mom and Dad know how to sit and be quiet. They're so peaceful. Yeah. And then your child can sit next to you when you do that. Yeah. So small things like that. Sometimes having a shrine in your home. I knew one family, and the little girl, every morning she would go and give the Buddha a present, and the Buddha would also give her a present. Yeah, it was very sweet. So she learned how to make offerings to the Buddha. Other things. This is your chance. Yeah.
Very basic. You were talking about mindfulness, how to explain it, and what the word actually means. With me, it is emptiness. And I read the other day that it could also be explained as egolessness.
So, as what?
So egolessness.
Your egolessness.
Uh-huh.
And is that a correct interpretation of emptiness? Or can it even be described as such?
Are you asking about emptiness or mindfulness?
No, emptiness.
Emptiness. Okay. So, emptiness, one translation is egolessness. But we have to understand, what does it mean by ego? That's a very confusing word in English. Yeah, so I usually don't use that. What emptiness refers to is when we, our wrong conception mind, when we look at things, they look as if, they appear to us as if they are real, as if they had a real independent essence from their own side. Yeah. What emptiness is talking about is that things lack that kind of independent essence. But they do exist dependently. Okay? So emptiness doesn't mean nothingness. Yeah. It's a lack of an unrealistic way of existence that we project on people and phenomena. Okay? But it's not total non-existence. Yeah, well, I prefer not to use the term egolessness because it's very confusing. Because what does ego mean? When Freud talked about ego, his definition of ego and how the word is used in contemporary language now are very, very different. So what do people mean when they say egolessness? What do they mean when they say ego? You know? So that's why I shy away from that word, because I think it can be very, very easily misunderstood. Yeah. What it's referring to is, you know, the whole concept is we have this image of ourself as like, I'm here, and I'm the most important person in the world. You know? And especially when something happens we don't like, there's a very strong feeling of me, isn't it? I don't like this. This has got to stop. I said so. Or I really want this. You know, the whole way we see the self or the person, the I, is in a very exaggerated way, as if it had its own essence there. When actually, It doesn't. Yeah. The self exists, but it exists dependent on many, many other factors. Okay. So that's what we're talking about. Okay. Things dependently exist, but they're not solid, concrete. So we refer to the person, you know. How are you doing? I am me. This is mine. Yeah. Yeah, the whole idea of mine is a very good way to see how we solidify things. Yeah. When this is just sitting here, you know, oh, it's a gong. So what? Yeah? Or actually, car is a better example. Gong, we don't feel much emotion for. Yeah, gong. But a car, yeah? When you see there's that beautiful car that you've really wanted to get, you know? I don't know if it's a Ferrari or a BMW or whatever it is, but this gorgeous car. It's at the dealer's, yeah? You go and watch it at the dealer's. If it gets scratched when it's at the dealer's, does that bother you? No. I mean, cars at dealers, they get scratched all the time. They do. It's too bad for the dealer. If I go and I trade some paper for that car, I give people some paper, or sometimes I give them some plastic, and they let me drive the car home. Yeah? And I drive the car home. My car. Look at my BMW. Look at this. Isn't this? Or my Mercedes. Look at this car. This is gorgeous. My car. And then the next morning you walk out and there's a big dent in the side. Then, what is it? Who dented my car? Oh, I gotta get that person who dented my new car. Okay, what's the difference? When the car was at the car dealer's, if it got a dent, you didn't care. But the same car, after you gave that person some paper or plastic and you took the car, and now instead of parking at the dealer's, it's parked in front of your house, now if it gets dented, this is pretty serious business. What's different? The difference is the word my. When it's at the dealer's house, it is not mine. I don't care what happened to it. When I am now eligible to call it mine, then I care a whole lot about what happens to it. Has anything really change substantially in the car? No. What's changed is the label we put on that car. That's all. Just the label. But we forget that it's just a designation, just a term, yours or mine. And instead, when we hear the word mine, ooh, it's mine has some big meaning, doesn't it? You don't mess around with something that is mine. But the car is the same. Okay. So what we're getting at is it's not in the car. There's not a difference in the car. Yeah. There's a difference in how we are conceptually thinking about the car. And how we conceptually think about I and mine and me. making everything that happens to us like super concrete and incredibly important. But is it really? No. Okay. So it's a good exercise in your life to watch what happens as soon as you label something mine or my. Yeah, like when you have a child. Yeah, your first grade child comes home with an F on their spelling test. Ah, my child has an F on their spelling test. They're never going to get into Harvard. They're going to be a failure. They're never going to have a job or an education because they are in first grade and they failed their spelling test. This is a disaster. If your neighbor's kid is in first grade and fails their spelling test, does it bother you? Do you think that kid's going to be a failure their whole life? No. What's the difference? That word, mine. Okay. Mine is it can be a troublesome word. Because it's not just a word. We give it all this meaning that it doesn't have from its own side, but what we impute on it. And that causes us a lot of problems. Okay. I remember years ago, I was invited to Israel. In fact, they tell me I was the first Buddhist teacher to go to Israel. And I remember leading a retreat in the Negev Desert down in the south. And we were in a kibbutz that was right on the border with Jordan. Okay. Jordan is one of Israel's peaceful neighbors. You know, I also, at one point, was up near the Syrian border and the Lebanese border, which aren't so peaceful. But anyway, at this time, I was in a kibbutz in the south. And I remember standing, because the kibbutz was right on the border, you know. There was a fence. This side was Israel, the fence. That side, there was a patch of about 6 feet of sand that was combed, because that way they could tell if anybody stepped on it, you know, because it would interfere with the way it was combed. And then on the other side of that was just the rest of Jordan. And I remember standing on that fence, you know, at the fence line and looking and thinking, you know, people fight wars depending on where you put a fence and what you call a piece of sand. That piece of dirt or sand on that side of the fence is called Jordan. On this side, it's called Israel. And people kill each other based on what you call a piece of dirt. Do you give that the name Jordan or do you give the name Israel? You know? And look at the Middle East now. Yeah. Do you give that piece of dirt the name ISIS or Syria, or Iraq, or Kurdistan, who knows? But people are fighting over what you call the dirt. Yeah? And that comes from our ignorance, because we're imputing things that onto phenomena that they don't have from their own side. And then we fight about it. Okay. So, let's sit quietly for about 2 minutes. I call this digestion meditation. To just think about what we talked about, and then have your prayer sheet nearby, because we will do the dedication verses on it after our 2-minute meditation. suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born